themselves seamstresses for a reason.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Jonathan Lethem, is a man of many lives. For one, because of his return to New York as both setting and muse in novels such as Motherless Brooklyn, Fortress of Solitude, and Chronic City, he may be New York's closest thing to having a bard. But Lethem is known as well for his genre fiction, his hard-boiled detective and science fiction books, his revival of the Marvel comic Omega the Unknown, and for editing the Library of America's four-volume edition of Philip K. Dick's novels. Yet another side of Jonathan Lethem is that of essayist on music and culture, with books about John Carpenter, the New York Mets, and the Talking Heads, with his remarkable Rolling Stone interview of Bob Dylan, and a profile of James Brown that the New York Times says stands as the best writing ever about the greatest musician of the post-World War II era. Given all of these accomplishments, it is no small thing that many call Lethem's latest novel, Dissident Gardens, his best. Spanning three generations in 80 years, from the Jewish communists of Queens in the 1930s to the folk revivalists of Greenwich Village in the 1960s to the modern-day Occupy movement, Dissident Gardens is both an intimate and epic portrayal of the American left, of American Jews in the 20th century, and of one family's quest for transformation and self-reinvention one generation to the next. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jonathan Lethem.
Thanks for having me. What a great intro that was.
So the novel opens with Rose Zimmer, a Jewish communist in Sunnyside Gardens, Queens, who's about to be expelled from her communist cell for sleeping with a black cop. And it seems like Rose Zimmer is the engine behind Dissident Gardens in many ways. So can you introduce our listeners to
absolutely.
Her? Sure,
absolutely. She's right. So she's of the generation that became radicalized concurrent with the high point of American communism. And also, you know, this is during the Great Depression. So there was this sort of sense that the workers had better do something, that, you know, that something was needed, and also that even the center, you know, with FDR, that the center of American political life was moving towards the workers, right? And she's coming out of an immigrant Jewish family, and at great cost, kind of intellectual and emotional cost, has thrust aside the religious beliefs of her parents and her sisters, and she has embraced this secular materialist worldview, and she is a total firebrand, iconoclast, bully, you know, emotional Stalinist who reorders the world of her family and her neighborhood and anyone she ever meets according to her will.
There's this great passage when you're describing her handling vinyl records with a lot of ritual and reverence that relates back to the ritual and reverence of the religious practices of her Jewish ancestors. But that would be a comparison that she would be appalled that she was making it. And it made me think a lot about the Jewish left, and that being something very Jewish in the Jewish left, paradoxically, this idea that they would rather not attribute any of their actions to their Jewishness.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I became very interested in the way, in this character, that the hangover of her Jewish identity was creeping up on her in every possible way. And, you know, of course, the 20th century seemed to be designed as a kind of tricky rebuke to an internationalist, a Jewish, formerly Jewish internationalist revolutionary who then sees the Hitler-Stalin pact and then learns about the Holocaust. It's as though she's being thrust back into identifying with the victimized Jews of Europe, right, as she's thought that she could transcend all of that.
It was interesting. It reminded me, when I finished reading People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, I emailed him, this was many years ago, and he responded. And I was like, I thought it was interesting that I didn't see a whole lot of Jews in the book. I saw some Yiddish trade unions, but yeah. I knew that a lot of Jews were involved in, say, the Freedom Riders movement, which you go into a little bit in Dissident Gardens.
Yeah.
And he responded saying, but the Jews never organized themselves as Jews.
That's it.
And so right.
they
I'm
might
not going to bring
but
it up.
They don't, they, that's not what they thought mattered. Exactly. Yeah. So
another interesting thing about Dissident Gardens is the setting, which is almost a character in and of itself. Can you talk about Sunnyside Gardens?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was a place that was very magical to me, the idea of it growing up. And I, in a way, that thread, that curiosity that I had is really the point of origin for the whole book. My mother and grandmother had lived there, but only briefly. They'd sort of exiled themselves to the other side of the tracks in Queens. But it was in this vision that I was offered, it was like a socialist utopian precinct that somehow they'd failed it or they couldn't navigate life there. But, you know, I always thought how different things would be if they'd somehow stayed in Sunnyside Gardens. Well, of course, it's a place with a legacy of, you know, disappointment and compromise, but it still also has this weird beauty, this uncanny quality of being a very simpatico, community-minded place to live, and people remember the legacy of how, you know, neighbor bailed out neighbor when they couldn't afford their rent in this place, and some of that is almost also, you know, baked in. It's part of the architecture. These blocks were designed around these communal garden spaces, which, you know, during the 30s, when people were starving, people would farm in these backyards. And of course, then later these backyards were kind of balkanized. People would carve them into private, traditional private backyards and put up a little white fence and put a grill there or something. So it seemed like the space of the gardens was like an allegory of the privatization of the commons, which is a, you know, a version of a political story about what's happened to the American commons, the American communal ideal. That's very moving to me.
And it's interesting that all of these characters really see socialism and being American is very intertwined. It's not like today where it's an accusation of being an anti-American, but
yeah.
It's actually very much one of one thing.
Yeah. Well, of course, I didn't invent this. There was a very specific slogan, you know, which I joke about in the book. By the time the characters hear it, they regard it as a kind of noxious cliche, a little bit too pat, but, you know, communism is 20th century Americanism. The idea that this coming world revolution was actually an extension of the American experiment to begin with. It was a revival of an extension of what you know, the story that this place embodied. And I did come, in a way, to see my understanding of my characters became that, you know, the United States paradoxically could never have been a great home for socialism per se, or for, you know, Marxism, in a way, because it was too much an experiment itself. It was a place of utopian experiments. Therefore, utopian experiments come here both to die, but also to be incorporated, to be absorbed, to have their spirit incorporated, they become part of the legacy of this place. And I think this is really true probably even, you know, all over the spectrum. You know, I mean, if you look at the Tea Party, you know, you're looking at another version of that American fitful, you know, always at odds, always a dissident movement coming up that claims to have the real story, that claims to know what America is really for. It's a utopian visionary place to begin with.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with Jonathan Lethem about his latest novel, Dissident Gardens. There were a couple interesting choices that around the Rose Zimmer section of the book that I really loved because they were surprising. When I think of Jews and their loyalty to a president, for instance, I always think of FDR.
Yeah.
And you've really foregrounded Lincoln. And I want to hear more about this connection for Rose between Lincoln and Marx, something that might not be obvious on first glance. So can you tell us a little bit about why you went that direction?
Well, I mean, you have a whopping big clue, right, in the Lincoln Brigades being called the Lincoln Brigades, right? But I also, my personal version of the left and New York City and my family, it had so much to do with the Jewish reverence for and fascination with the plight of the American Negro and the involvement in the civil rights movement. And so Lincoln, of course, is a fetish for that reason as well. And this was, in fact, this was very true of my grandmother. She kind of wore her Lincoln love on her sleeve in a way that, you know, was exciting and puzzling to me as a kid. It always seemed almost like sexualized. So I went ahead and did that in the book, you know. But I also suppose that I'm contending in this book in a way that's, you know, it's really important to me. It's sort of elusive, but with the whole problem of the left's, you know, fascination with the rural and the agrarian and the pastoral, you know, and one of Rose's weird instincts is she figures out, wait, if the left has a future, it's in the cities. Forget the farmers. The farmers don't want to be communists. They're never going to do it. But, you know, so this cuts against, you know, and that's why she finds the folk movement so specifically exasperating, is because she sees it recapitulating this sentimental, you know, the Dust Bowl, Okies, and so forth. She's like, oh God, can't we stop with, you know, with the, you know, fantasy about the farmers, or the, you know, the country folk. But Lincoln, for her, is a reverse example. She's like, well, you know, he's – yeah, sure, he comes from the country, but he was smart enough to, like, come to – you know, he knew where the action was. He was – he became educated. He became – he might carry with him a kind of a – the DNA of the backwoods, but he was – he wanted to be – he was an intellectual. And then again, there is this citation – it's a great citation in one of his speeches where he talks about the essentially the evils of capital.
I even wrote it down.
Yeah,
here.
It's a real thing. I mean,
yeah,
I,
no. So I'll just say it because it's fascinating. And you stated that it actually he wrote it, you know, prior to Marx. So it sounds like it's right out of the Communist Manifesto. And says, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital could never exist if labor had not existed first. Labor is superior to capital and deserves higher consideration. We never hear that quoted now.
No. And there he is, the founder of the Republican Party. You know, I mean, obviously, we could. It's, you can't stop enumerating the ways that the American center has moved away from any notion of these, you know, these kind of, I mean, you know, one of the reasons that Occupy mattered so much to me was a very paradoxical set of occurrences that can make you feel very mixed up. But it did something so definite and so absolute at the very start, and I think people overlook this. It reintroduced a vocabulary where capitalism was a thing you could be against. It gave capitalism back its name, right? Suddenly there was such a thing as an anti-capitalist sentiment. And, you know, when I look at I often think of these things because I'm a word guy. I look at them in terms of words, and somehow words become outmoded or embarrassed, or they only exist in history books. But, you know, trust busting. There used to be like a popular common sentiment that trusts needed to be busted in American life, right? And now we hear that and it just sounds antique. It's like something that once happened. But what if we just actually called the trusts that float into our lives right now? Obviously, all sorts of corporations and, you know, networks that just dominate vast regions of some industry or some part of our civic discourse, they're trusts, right? So what if there was a trust-busting populism alive again, you know? This idea of names and words, you know, so the fact that Lincoln could use these terms like capital, I mean, it you know, if you saw a elected official now, whether Democrat or Republican, even use the word capital, it would be like a red flag. You know, oh, maybe they were the Manchurian candidate. Maybe they were a commie who'd been brainwashed. But for Lincoln, it was a term of discourse.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. I think one way you could look at your last book, Chronic City, and this one, Dissident Gardens, is as mirrors of each other in the sense that Chronic City is really about going on with your life and sort of denial of all the horrible things happening at the margins. And in this book, every character is really motivated by the larger questions and how they're implicated in those larger questions, which you think of with the return of the Occupy movement. And it makes me think that it was a really interesting and good choice that you didn't focus on McCarthyism as the way, an external thing that caused the downfall of communism in America, but you really focused on Khrushchev's speech, which would cause sort of an internal, principled, existential dilemma for the communists when they learn about the purges of Stalin.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on a technical level, I was tiptoeing very carefully up to the problem of the historical novel, which is, you know, not an easy one. And I wanted to do, American communism without any McCarthy hearings. You know, I wanted to do the 60s without any, there's no assassinations, you know, and I don't glance at all these kind of, you know, the fear would be to end up with a kind of Forrest Gump history, right? So I wanted to do the other experiences that people were having, the intimate relationships, but as you say, to these gigantic questions. What I also want to say is how grateful I am to hear you link Chronic City to this one, because for me, that book was so political, although its subject was the denial, the amnesia, the sublimation of historical reality in the pressures of late capitalism, you know, how powerful that engine of amnesia can be.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today with Jonathan Lethem about his latest novel, Dissident Gardens. In the second section of the book, we get introduced to Rose's daughter, Miriam, who really is the other central character of Dissident Gardens. We really get a meditation on the folk revival in Greenwich Village. And she really reminded me, Miriam really reminded me in a weird way as a reverse Charles Swan in Swan's Way and Proust, in the sense that we have these insider-outsider Jewish characters who, in Swan's Way, he can go into the aristocratic salons, but he can never really belong. And similarly, in reverse, Miriam can go into the outer borough culture, the black culture, the poor culture, and in a way in which other people aren't feeling as comfortable.
Yeah.
Is that parallel sound?
That's very interesting. I mean, it's great. I mean, I think she is a character of street wisdom and kind of a kind of intrepidude. She's a child of the city, and she also has the problem of, you know, she embodies the double bind of being other people's muse in a way, of enchanting, being enchanting in the world. You know, and I joke about this issue in the book in different ways for different characters. You know, Cicero, who we haven't discussed, is kind of a black token. And he's a very brazen character and a very bold character, but he also knows that he's functioning in a way like a kind of a, you know, a magical Negro for folks. And then at the end, that girl in the Occupy camp is joked about as being a Marxist pixie dream girl. And, you know, I think Miriam is also one of these characters who has discovered how to represent a kind of a magical feeling of access and fluency to others, but that's costly. You become talismanic, and she's a talisman of New York City's secret nature of access to different classes and cultures, outer boroughs and Manhattan. She seems to hold the key for others to connecting, and she has an innate, you know, people remark on it, an innate kind of communal spiritual gift. She makes people feel like they're part of something, but, you know, but then of what?
Well, what's interesting about both with Cicero and Miriam and this issue of being a talisman brings us back to the issue that you go into in the folk movement of authenticity, which also links back to Rose and her aversion to this sort of false agrarianism with communism, because we have all of these people from Chicago and New York who are acting like they were miners or they were hobos.
Right. Absolutely.
And and also Miriam's partner, who's acting more Irish than he really is, essentially, in this Irish band of brothers. And I just really thought that section was both very poignant and comical at the same time. And I saw this parallel with the Dylan figure in this section and Khrushchev in the first section. and what I mean by that is we have this transition for the communists, for Khrushchev, and his speech. And for Dylan, it's this transition from the collective voice of the folk to this more open-ended contemporary music that is also more individualistic and poetic, of the, which represents right. the 60s, sort of in the way that Rose is part of the collective, and then when Khrushchev happens, it breaks apart into something.
I love that connection because I never would have thought of it, and it seems so right now that I'm going to claim it, of course, as my own whenever I talk about the book. Yes. I mean, there is this sense of, you know, I think I write again and again and again, and this is outside of politics. It's outside of any set of signifiers, although I often use some set of signifiers to embody it. I write about the temporary nature of our experiences of belonging, communities, you know, whether and I just stack up examples from various books, but whether it's, you know, a gang of boys who form on a street for a little while and feel like they're the Dean Street boys, or it's a group of misfits who go to a science fiction convention and for 3 days in a Radisson, they function as a kind of alternative cultural reality, and then they all have to go back to their jobs where they're just the nerd who wears the Star Trek, you know, pin on their lapel. Or it's a rock band. It's people coming together and forming this brief gestalt, you know, voice that expresses something that none of them are equal to individually, but that these things are always fragile. We pass through them, neighborhoods, families, movements, and we are struck by them. They seem to be a vision of a world that we want to stay inside, but it can't sustain.
That's interesting. And there's a really insightful section in the folk section around how Jews could be authentic in their inauthenticness in the music scene, maybe because of their history of dispossession. So we talk
right.
about how
absolutely
Rambling Jack Elliott and Dylan could really pull off this persona or multiple personas, maybe in the way Miriam's Irish husband failed at, or maybe
do.
Phil Oakes for right. that matter. Why isn't Phil Oakes Bob Dylan?
Right. Why is he not mercurial in that way? Well, maybe he should have been Jewish. That's great. I love that. And I think that, you know, I would go further and say also that, you know, in thinking about the part of the book that, I mean, there's so many parts of this book, we'll drive your listener crazy, but where the husband returns to Germany, he decides he's more German than Jewish, even though he had to run away from the Holocaust, that the fluency with which Jews could become politically shapeshifters, Marxists, internationalists, repatriated East Germans, has to do maybe with this, you know. I mean, it's also, it's the belief that encompasses skepticism, right? To be a Jew is not to believe in God, but to be troubled by the question of whether or not you can believe in God.
Yeah, and I know a lot of reviewers have, or interviewers have asked you or noted that Dissident Gardens doesn't have any of the fantastical or genre elements of a lot of your previous books, but I felt like it would have been weird to have them because the book in and of itself is so fantastical in its realism. You know, it makes me think of, you know, The Counter Life by Philip Roth, this idea that of self-reinvention and metamorphosis. You have Jews going back to Israel, you have Jews going to East Germany, you have Jews trying to assimilate through communism.
Yeah.
And then you have Bob Dylan and his million personas.
All the transmutations. Well,
it seems like a metamorphic book.
Yeah, I love that description. And I'm honored by the comparison to what I think is Roth's great, very much greatest book. I mean, above all, his other great ones. But I you know, in this question of where's the fantastic element? I've always felt, for me, what I'm interested in is the reality we all consent to, the consensual, you know, rap on the table, it's there kind of stuff. And under the pressure of dream or fantasy or some kind of field of distortion. So when I introduce a fantastic element into a story, it's not that different from the way, say, Tourette's functions as this distorting field in the reality of motherless Brooklyn, or in this case, ideology, utopianism, the power of the crazy dream that's alive for these characters of living in a world other than the one we're in is by far enough, as you say, a fantastic element because it distorts the reality we all understand that we live in so powerfully for them.
One of the really fun things for me is there were so many facts in this book that I didn't believe, and then I went and looked them up and they were true, like the amount of African-American support for Eisenhower.
Yeah.
Because you have a character who's a Republican black cop, and I'm like, really, were there all these African-Americans supporting Eisenhower? And
including Jackie Robinson.
Yeah. And then you had even a flirtation between Nixon and Martin Luther King in his first running for president.
Yeah.
And then the leading role the communists played in trying to integrate baseball.
Yeah.
Which was fascinating.
History is so full of these extraordinary specifics that you could never account for or accept. And if you invented them, people would say you'd gone too far.
I imagine this book took an enormous amount of research.
Yeah, there was a lot of research, and it was sideways. I would just go, you know, I'd follow my own obsessions into weird corners. And, you know, so for a while it seemed like, oh, the book is going to be half about baseball. This whole idea of the Continental League was going to become this giant thing. And I shrank that back down, and little traces remain. But I learned so many things, and only a very small number of them can even get into the book, because a few facts are all that fiction can handle.
Did you know going in that this was going to be a very female-centric book? I know that there's characters who are quite dimensional and powerful, like Cicero in the book also, but it feels like Rose and Miriam are really carrying the day for me.
I think you're right. It belongs most to Rose and Miriam, and then I would say third most to Cicero. But, you know, there's a place where this book connects really powerfully to the life of my grandmother and my mother as I knew them, but also as I couldn't know them, because they both were gone before I could interrogate or fill in the details. And so I had to make them up instead. And so that was one of the most kind of baseline things driving this book emotionally as a project for me. But I also, you know, there's a if you know The Fortress of Solitude, which is for many people, rightly and understandably, seen as, you know, my autobiographical book. One of the weird things in that book is that, of course, the emotional, as a container for the autobiographical emotion, it's very direct. But I actually changed a lot of the factual stuff around in ways that became quite misleading. And the boy and the father live very much alone in this house in the book. And the facts of my childhood were almost the opposite. My house was super populated. It was a commune. There were lots of people around. My parents had boyfriends and girlfriends. I had siblings, all of whom have been somehow evaporated to isolate the boy and the father in that book. And when people ask me why I'd done that or where it came from, since my life wasn't like that, I hadn't really thought about it, but I immediately realized, and this was only after finishing the book, that there was an answer. And the answer was that I was unconsciously thinking about my own mother's life alone in an apartment in Queens with my grandmother, and that this had meant something to me that had been transmitted almost somatically through my family experience, but I hadn't really grasped how important it was. That something about being, you know, a same sex, a mother and daughter, I transferred them into a father and son in the book, that was actually the secret subject there. So I decided, okay, well, what if I went at that directly? And so that was a big part of the book. So that Miriam and Rose feel like they're what it all pivots around makes total sense to me.
And the title really evokes paradoxically and evocatively the sense of belonging and the sense of exile at the same time.
Well, nice. I like that description too.
Can you tell our listeners what you're working on now and how it might be different than what you've just achieved?
Yeah, I'm working on almost nothing. I'm taking an unusual amount of time off after this book in order to replenish and think about what's coming next. I've got a few books that I'm sort of thinking I could write, and I'm just browsing in my mind among them. I'm sort of enjoying keeping them all in a kind of twilight space where I don't pick. You know, once I pick one, the others all will die on the vine. Right now, they're all sort of semi-alive to me, and I'm just gazing at them and thinking, wow, you could be a book. What I'm doing to keep my hands busy, I spent the summer, well, I wrote a big review of that Thomas Pynchon novel, and I wrote a liner note for a Bob Dylan, compilation of people covering Bob Dylan songs from the 80s. That was my summer, those were my two summer projects. But I've been away from fiction for a little while now.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers, and it was a deeply pleasurable read to read Dissident Gardens.
Well, what a great talk. Thank you so much.
We're talking today with Jonathan Lethem about his latest book, Dissident Gardens. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO's fall membership drive starts on the 10th, and you could help make reaching our fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matching money is a really great motivator to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate. So please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to sign up or have any questions. Or just call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your fall drive matching gift today.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Now you just buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I never get back. Now it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a crime. 'Cause it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Hello, this is O.B. Hill on a special edition of Black Book Talk on KBOO. And I have a special guest here today by the name of Mr. Billy Fields. Mr. Fields, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, you know, this is a real important day, especially for me.